What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Scott, thank you very much. Welcome to The Exchange, everybody. I'm Tyler Matheson, in for Kelly Evans. Here's what's ahead. Busy hour in stock for you. Stocks higher, yields lower, investors digest mixed economic data. Business activity in April grew at the slowest pace so far this year, while new orders fell for the first time in 6 months. Companies also scaled back jobs for the first time in almost 4 years. But manufacturing input costs hit a one-year high. Services demand remains strong. So what does all this mean for the Fed? Our economists will make the case for a July interest rate cut. Meanwhile, new home sales, their highest reading since September, as builders pull back on prices, offer incentives to offset higher interest rates. We'll talk to the CEO of the real estate developer, Howard Hughes Holdings, about the demand trends he's seeing right now. Plus, you got Tesla shares snapping a 7-day losing streak ahead of earnings. The stock hitting a 52-week low yesterday. But one shareholder finding a few silver linings and a vote of confidence for Elon Musk's Musk. What's got her bullish coming up? But before we get to all that, let's get to Dom Chu for a check on today's market action. Dom.
All right. So, Ty, a pretty strong follow up to yesterday's rally. We are now a solid 2% above the levels that we saw just on Friday. So a 2-day bounce back for the markets overall. Let's get you the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up about 240 points. It's half of 1%, 38,480. The S&P 500 is at 5,066, up 56 points. That's a north of 1% gain. And it's been a positive day. Even at the lows of the session, we were up 17 points in the S&P, up roughly 61 at the highs. So tilting towards the higher end of that range. The NASDAQ composite, the tech heavier side of things, pacing the advance up 1.5%, 225 points or 15,675, the last level for the NASDAQ composite index. Three earnings movers headlines among the many that are out there. We'll start with two generals out there. General Motors first, up 5%. The automaker comes out with better profits, better revenues than expected, also boosts its full year profit forecast, thanks in large part to strength in North America and better sales of trucks and SUVs. So watch GM. The other general we're watching is a former general in terms of General Electric, now known as GE Aerospace. And they're completely spun off, three separate companies, but the aerospace side is up 6.5% today. Better than expected profits, better than expected revenues. They raised their full year forecast. More airlines and commercial companies are now servicing their airlines and jets more just because there's not as many new jets to buy. So the maintenance repair, the demand for those services and parts helping to drive GE Aerospace up 6.5%. And then watch what's happening with Spotify. This is a massive move higher. It's up about roughly 16.5%, and that's off the highs of the session so far. The streaming audio and podcast company, better than expected earnings results and revenues. It's adding subscribers again, and it also gave a forecast for monthly active users that came in ahead of some analyst expectations. Also a profit margin forecast. Spotify up 16%. Some positivity, Ty. I'll send things back over to you.
All right, Dominic, thank you very much. With just 1 week left until the next meeting, let's dig into what the recent data mean for the Federal Reserve. Chair Powell striking a somewhat hawkish tone on inflation last week, pushing rate cut expectations out even further. But our next guest says a July cut is still in the cards. Joining us now, Carl Riccadonna, chief U.S. economist at BNP Paribas, along with CNBC senior economics reporter Steve Leisman. Gentlemen, welcome to both of you. Carl, let me begin with you. Are you seeing signs of a somewhat slower economy? And is that one reason why you're still predicting a July rate cut?
Well, I think we are seeing some moderation in the pace of economic activity. I will be my own team's forecasting about 2.7% growth in Q1, so still a robust pace, but cooler than what we saw in the prior two quarters. But I think what we need to focus on at the moment, it's very well advertised and well discussed in economic circles, including from the Fed, that we're in the midst of some degree of a labor supply shock, which means that given two sources, one immigration, another is labor force participation. We have a lot more workers. We have a bigger economy than we realized. And so we have to accept some of that frothier economic data with not the same perception of what the inflationary consequences will be. And so a prime example of that, if we could just look back to the last jobs report, 300,000 on non-farm payroll seems like a very hot number. But nonetheless, average hourly earnings in that report moving to a post-recession, post-pandemic low. And so that tells you there is this rebalancing that's happening in the economy. And so we shouldn't take those activity data points at face value necessarily.
Steve, do you see the labor market as Carl does?
I think it should be slowing. It surprised us month after month here, Tyler. But about the July rate cut, we can still get there. And forgive this tease, for which I'm not paid additional money, but really interested in what your home builder has to say later on, because yes, a key to getting to the July cut is what happens to home prices. And I'm reading a report now by Capital Economics that says all signs still point to lower shelter inflation. You remember the shelter
and
inflation.
You've got to get that, right? Because shelter has been so high.
I don't see how we get there without it. In fact, Goolsbee last week repeated his comment, Austin Goolsbee, the Chicago Fed president, that we can't get to 2% without lower housing inflation. So if we can get that number down, that's a third of the CPI. It's not as much of the PCE, but it's still a decent chunk. If we can get there, we have oil prices look like they're coming a bit off the boil. If we get there, we'll have squeaked it in. Is that the right word?
You said it.
Squoke
like it
in, whatever it is.
I like it.
Thank you for the help with the past tense of that verb there, Tyler. But in any event, we'll have just barely got there because the Fed wants a couple months to get the confidence. I do think they ought to be cutting here because they said they wanted 2.6 on inflation for the year. They're getting 2.8. They've dialed in 75 basis points of rate cuts. Why wouldn't you cut something of 75 basis points if all you're doing is overshooting your inflation target by 0.2?
Carl, I want to come back to you and get your thoughts on housing and that industry generally. But before I do that, I want to break away. Two of your notes up for auction. Rick Santelli has the numbers at CME. Rick.
Yes, we just auctioned off $69 billion two-year notes. That is a record size. Never, ever had an auction bigger than that. And the yield at this auction was 4.898, which is a half a basis point lower than the one issued market. Lower yield, higher price. Government's the seller. Higher prices are good. The grade I gave for this auction was a B+. B+. Let's go through it, shall we? Other than the pricing, which is the most important issue and it priced well, we see that the bid to cover was right spot on with 10 auction average of 2.66. Dealers took 15.1, spot on 10 auction average. Here's the ones that made a bit of a difference. 66.2 on indirects. That's the best since June of last year. And directs at 18.7 was the weakest since June of last year. Balanced out, B+. As you look, you can see we are currently at this very moment making new two-year low yields on the session. The big drop, of course, was 10 o'clock, 8:45 Central, 9:45 Eastern, when we saw some of the S&P Global PMIs come in on the weaker side, especially on the services. So yields extended. Normally, that's not a good thing. All the concession was already in the bowl before the auction, but investors still stepped up. Now, tomorrow we have five-year, another record all-time size auction at $70 billion. We finish off, of course, with seven-year notes. The package record size, $183 billion. But despite the record size, the investors seem to be happy to gobble down those two-year notes.
That's what I want to ask you. I'm no expert on this, Rick, but when you say numbers like $69 billion of two-year notes, tomorrow $70 billion worth of five-year notes, these are mammoth numbers that indicate sort of the financial state of this country, which doesn't smell all that good to me. But the market seems to be digesting these slugs of cash very easily.
Well, you know, we take it one auction at a time, Tyler. I agree. These numbers are huge. And just consider this. For the month of May with coupon issuance, we're looking at nearly $400 billion of issuance. So the issuance is going to remain large because we keep on spending. Now, just because this auction goes well doesn't mean the next one will. But ultimately, it's all about crowding out because whether it's the government or corporate America, 2024 is going to have a lot of rollover. We're going to have to find a home for lots of new paper.
All right. Thank you, Rick. Rick Santelli reporting there. Carl, let me turn to you in light of what Rick just reported. What is your view on that? I mean, the market does seem to be swallowing up these large slugs of issuance very comfortably. And as Rick points out, well, it does it until it doesn't.
Sure. Well, it seems to be taking it in stride for the moment. But as you cross into record large auctions, it does raise some concerns about, where the ultimate clearing price will be. And I know you wanted to talk about housing, so we can go there. If we look at, where a 10-year Treasury yield is trading or settling, that's a key driver of where mortgage rates are going. And I think a new reality is setting in with home buyers that we're not going to go back to those pandemic lows anytime soon, given the very soft landing in the economy, persistent inflation pressures, which are trending lower but taking some time to move there. And that means elevated mortgage rates with a 7 as the first number as opposed to 2 during the pandemic. Housing affordability, of course, gets squeezed considerably by that. By some metrics, it's housing's the least affordable since the early 1980s. That puts a lot of pressure on the sector. Now, because of the supply chain disruptions during the pandemic, I think we still see a lot of activity in the pipeline. So if we compare kind of under construction to completions, we see that there's still a lot of residual activity. But at some point later this year, that starts to rebalance. And for example, the construction sector might be a less reliable contributor to employment gains. And of course, there's lots of knock-on outside of the construction sector into specialty contractors and retailing, furniture, et cetera, et cetera. So there could be a compounding effect there. But to Steve's point on the inflation front, it's inflation in 3X, or disinflation in 3X, I should say. Act one was goods disinflation. Bravo, we've gone full circle. Act two is the shelter inflation story, and we're still in the middle of that. But these, the trend has been lower, and home prices are an important driver of the direction of shelter inflation. So my own team thinks that we'll see further disinflation on that front over the course of the year. Of course, a big chunk of the CPI, so it absolutely matters.
All right, Steve, I'm going to give you the last word here. Carl points out that maybe there is some disinflation in housing, but you've still got very strong demand for housing. New homes are selling really very briskly, and that would tell you that demand is high, supply is not that great. So where is the relief that needs to happen in housing and shelter costs to bring inflation down?
Yeah, so I've become a little skeptical that that's going to happen. I think if you lower prices, you bring a whole bunch of people back in. You lower the mortgage rate, you bring a whole bunch of people back in. There's all kinds of supply that's off the market right now. That could come back into the market.
Because people don't want to trade
Don't want to trade their 3% mortgage for a 7% mortgage. They might trade it for a 6. That could have some impact, but the decline in housing inflation will be something that's much more mechanical in that rents have come down, and that's one of the ways that they impute housing costs. I'm even wondering, Tyler, if the Fed needs to begin to look past the housing inflation in terms of setting monetary policy, because I don't know how much it's related to what they're doing. Of course, they have, as Goolsbee described it last week, he said, we have one tool, it's a screwdriver, and we tighten or we loosen, and that's it. And of course, some people drink that for breakfast.
All right. screwdriver. All right, thanks very much. And Carl Rigadona, thank you as well. Steve Leisman, appreciate it. While rate cut concerns leave markets on edge, our next guest says the recent pullback has eliminated some froth in the equity market, setting the stage for fewer earnings disappointments. He's Mark Avalone. He's president of Potomac Wealth Advisors. Mark, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
So you see the possibility that this little blow off of the steam is a good thing for equities.
Absolutely. I think it's a little test that investors go through. It sorts out investors that aren't committed to the names they own. And I think the valuations, while they didn't drop dramatically, it was a 3-week scare. And last Friday was a real wake up call. We think that the economy is still intact for growth and growth, strong GDP, strong employment, strong wage growth. I mean, I was listening to the conversation you had about the Fed and rates. We just think it's a strong economy. We think there will be rate cuts eventually, not as early as July, as we heard, because this economy is very, very strong. Travel is strong. Consumers are strong. We saw the numbers from GM. I just think we just keep going forward from here, and stocks present an opportunity in that environment.
Could this little rise in interest rates, not so little, that we've seen over the past couple of months, could that be setting up a bond rally later this year, whether in investment grade bonds, treasuries, whatever?
Well, we're thinking it will, and we're hoping it will for those people who are invested appropriately. If you are truly a moderate risk investor at a station in life, you're a little older, bonds have always served a purpose. Pension funds need them. And you recall just a few years ago when rates were so low, you were almost forced to go outside your risk profile. Pension funds and the like struggled. So we think that the 10-year, closer to 5 than it is to 4 right now, presents not only a coupon opportunity, but the reverse of those horrible losses we saw in a year ago. So we think that a bond portfolio is going to be rewarded. And on a risk-reward profile, if you can get a coupon, some capital gain, and get mid-high single digits relative to a stock market that's near an all-time high, a lot of investors are going to make that choice.
So, Mark, I know that you're interested in financials. You like them. We'll get to them in just a moment. But you also like some tech stocks. However, if I'm understanding you correctly, you like investing in technology stocks through ETFs, which does at least one thing that is very good, and that is it insulates you from a massive decline in an individual name, whether that individual name is, for example, a Tesla or a Palo Alto or others.
Right. And we've seen a rotation of those bad drops. You remember 2 years ago, Facebook went through them.
Yes.
Went through that correction. So it's unforeseen. And when it happens, it's quite severe. And what we say is if we truly believe in this sector, whether they're tech companies, tech-enabled companies, we think it's here to stay. It's a secular macro trend, and we want to own a broad basket of these names. We have great research firms that we can rely on to pick the underlying companies inside the ETFs, and we think investors are well-suited to avoid, as you referenced earlier, a Palo Alto, which dropped 30% practically in one day, and that's devastation to a portfolio or if you've overweighted that name, and that's why we like to diversify that risk.
And make the case for financials. You like the XLF.
We like mega cap banks and we like non-bank financials. We're still staying away from community and regionals, and the reasons are related. One of the reasons we like the mega cap banks is their cost of funds is so low. They are attracting dollars. They're online gathering machines, and that creates de facto a disadvantage for small and regional banks who then have to go out and pay more for deposits. So the net interest margin figures for the mega cap banks are going to continue to improve. The mega cap banks also have strong capital markets, trading activities. They're well diversified away from concentrations in real estate risk. So we think there are going to be winners in the financial sector, the larger banks, and the challenge is going to be on those smaller and regionals where you better be very careful if you're picking an individual name.
Mark Avalone, thank you very much. Mark is with Potomac Wealth Advisors. We appreciate your time today. All right, coming up, new home sales rebounded nearly 9% last month. We talked about it just a moment ago, and we will ask the Howard Hughes CEO how his company is dealing with growing demand and where he's seeing the greatest opportunity. Plus, we're in the thick of earnings. We will get the action, the story, and the trade on Visa, Boeing, and Hilton ahead of results. That's Hilton ahead. The Exchange is back after this.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
This episode is brought to you by AARP. 10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Back to the exchange, everybody. Sales of newly built homes saw their biggest monthly increase since 2022 in the month of March. Diana Olick joins us now to dig into those numbers. Hi, Di.
Hey, Ty. Yes, yeah, sales not only made a big jump in March, up nearly 9% month to month, but they also hit the highest level since September. There is a little grain of salt, though, as February's numbers were revised down by almost as much as the March gain. Now, builders did lower prices slightly, down close to 2% year over year, and supply is coming down. But this is really all about mortgage rates. In March, when these contracts were signed, mortgage rates bounced around 7%, half the month below and half slightly above. Now, we're solidly above 7, nearing 7.5%. I spoke this morning with the CEO of Pulte, which just reported Q1 earnings. It beat on the top and bottom lines, raised guidance for both revenue and margins, and did not lower home prices, but is aggressively buying down mortgage rates. Ryan Marshall told me that today's higher rates are already having an effect.
The one note that we are seeing is new traffic that's coming into the sales offices, albeit on just a limited few number of days. It has moderated just a tad. We think that's the consumer's reaction to the most recent uptick in rates. We're going to watch it.
Stocks of the big builders had been falling sharply this month as rates rose, but today's news on sales as well as Pulte's beat has the home building ETF ITV moving higher. Mortgage rates are down slightly so far this week. Tyler?
All right, Diana, thank you very much. And meantime, with the 30-year well above 7% and the Fed expected to hold rates steady, my next guest expects demand for new homes to keep climbing. New homes, that is, calling 2024 a golden age of home building. Joining us now, David O'Reilly, CEO of Howard Hughes Holdings, a commercial, residential, and mixed-use real estate developer. Mr. O'Reilly, welcome. You call this the golden age of home building. What contributes to that assessment?
Well, we have demand that's meaningfully outpacing supply. We see new home buyers, average age 35, entering the market, but it's really millennials' delayed household formation. About 12,000 people a day are turning 35. And wealthy retirees looking to move near their children and grandchildren, driving demand. You know, Diana just mentioned it. We saw increased guidance from Pulte, despite the fact that they're meaningfully buying down mortgage rates. And it's that unique confluence of strong demand, no supply because there's no resale inventory, and large public builders with a meaningful advantage through those rate buy-downs that are driving their results.
That is an important advantage that the home builders have, is the ability to offer that kind of purchase assistance to people who need it. I am blown away by where you are today. It's called Teravalis. Did I pronounce it correctly? It is a
that
new,
is correct.
It is a new development in the Phoenix market, 37,000 acres. You plan to build 100,000 homes there?
100,000 homes and 55 million square feet of commercial space over the next 40 to 50 years. This will be a city when we're done about the size of St. Louis. And we just closed contracts on our first almost 500 homes this past month. And we're under negotiations with builders for the next 500 lots later this year. It's incredibly exciting. There's a pent-up demand. And Phoenix is in the path of growth and relatively affordable compared to many other cities in this
what
country.
What do people want today in a new home or in a new home community development? I know they want the Sun Belt, but take it from there.
Walkability. They need connectivity to nature. They need great amenities, community centers that offer those conveniences that they may not be able to afford in a home that is modestly shrinking recently. Home sizes over the past 4 to 5 years have come down 8 to 10%, but they're still double where they were in the 80s and the 70s. We're still over 2,000 square feet on an average size of a new home. So if we can give them connectivity to nature, great trail systems, great schools, and an amenity base that is, far outpacing our competition, we think these communities will continue to thrive.
Do the millennials, do the Gen Xers, do they sort of want the same thing that the 55 plus people want?
They do. I think the younger generation, the millennials and Gen Xers, are looking for More environmentally friendly homes, those that are more green, as well as trying to find within their community that, you know, third place to work. You know, they work in their office, they work at home, but that third place is really, really important. Whereas the retirees, those that are turning 65, that are largely boomers and very wealthy, given the housing run-up they've enjoyed over the past 30, 40 years, are choosing to live near their children and grandchildren. So by de facto, they want those same things because their children are those that are seeking those amenities that I just mentioned.
Forgive me for not knowing. I know you build and operate developments. You have the Seaport in New York. You have Summerlin in Nevada and other things. But you're also an enormous landowner, as I understand it. Do you then sell off parcels of land to other builders for them to build and operate developments or what?
That's exactly right. We sell the residential land to our home builder partners, mostly large public, large private builders. We take that capital and use it to build the amenities in our communities that we need: office buildings, apartment buildings, shopping, dining, experiences, theater, arts, et cetera. And that's our self-fulfilling cycle. The more we amenitize our communities, the more our land is worth, the more money we earn from selling it to home builders. And that goes on and on for decades.
Do you have any concerns about commercial real estate? Everybody seems to be wringing their hands at least a little bit about it. And I don't mean to paint commercial real estate with a broad brush. There's obviously industrial, which is doing very well. But offices have been a weak spot.
Certainly. And it's been the bifurcation of office buildings between the haves and the have-nots. Those that are highly amenitized, Class A space, and offer short commutes for their employees continue to outperform, whereas the far-flung surface park, 2- and 3-story tilt construction are going to continue to suffer. We've benefited that our office portfolio is entirely contained within our communities. In the Woodlands alone, our office portfolio has increased occupancy several points over the last several quarters. And it's largely driven because we offer, you know, less than a 10-minute commute for those that live in and work in the Woodlands. And that benefit has really materialized into some great results for us.
Final quick question here. Your longtime chairman of the board, Bill Ackman, a person who's very familiar to CNBC viewers, is just stepping away from the board. He's been there for, 14, 15 years. What has he meant to the company?
He's been our driving force. He created the Howard Hughes Corporation out of bankrupt General Growth Properties 14 years ago and has been instrumental in creating this incredible platform over that time period. He may be stepping off the board, but I am certain he will remain intimately involved in Howard Hughes going forward.
Well, he's going to be a big shareholder, so he will remain intimately involved if we know Bill. Thank you so much, David. We appreciate it. Come back anytime.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, David O'Reilly. Coming up, Tesla shares up 2% ahead of its earnings report. Can they boost investor confidence? Is Elon Musk an asset or a problem? We'll dig into that. Plus, Meta set a new spending record for lobbying last quarter, but it's not the only tech giant shelling out millions. We will discuss when the exchange returns after this.
This episode is brought to you by AARP. 10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
Welcome back to The Exchange. I'm Bertha Coombs, and this is your CNBC News update at this hour. During testimony in Donald Trump's hush money trial, former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker testified that his arrangement with Trump and former lawyer Michael Cohen was an agreement among friends, not in writing. Pecker also testified how any stories about Trump or the 2016 election were to be given straight to him and needed to stay secret because it was to help Trump's presidential campaign. The Justice Department just announced a $138.7 million settlement over the FBI's mishandling of assault allegations against former USA gymnastics team doctor Larry Nassar. Along with that settlement, about $1 billion has been set aside to compensate hundreds of Nassar's victims. And X is launching a TV app today as it makes its push into video. The app includes features like a trending video algorithm and cross-device compatibility, so users can start watching on one device and then continue on another. No ads for now, but the X team says it plans to monetize the app later. I was just talking about X and their forays into video with Steve Kovac, and this isn't their first time they've tried this.
No, no, and it seems to be a growing venue for people to consume content, as so many of these things that show up on your device are. I mean, it's the way my son consumes most of his video content, apart from the Knicks games. Bertha, thanks. All right, still ahead, we will trade Tesla and Boeing ahead of those results. But before we do that, let's get a check on a name that's already reported. That would be JetBlue, sinking. Weaker than expected revenue guidance there, thanks in part to weakness in Latin America. CEO Joanna Garrity telling CNBC the airline is pulling all the right levers to get back on the path to profitability, but it'll take some time to get there. JetBlue shares down about 16%. The exchange will be right back after this. All right, welcome back to the exchange, everybody. Tesla shares higher ahead of this afternoon's earnings. So will today's results be enough to bolster investor sentiment after yet another price cut? Our Phil LeBeau joins us now with a quick look. Hey, Phil.
Hey, Tyler. Much of what we're going to hear this afternoon is going to the movement of the stock will depend on what we hear from Elon Musk during the conference call. With that said, when it comes to the Q1 results, people will be focused on A, do they hit the mark in terms of earnings per share? The estimate is for 51 cents a share, and revenue, which is expected to come in at 22.15 billion. That's the estimates that are out there right now. Having said that, the conference call is really what's going to drive the stock after hours. Three things in particular. One, what's the robotaxi plan? Two, is the small car, the so-called Model 2, still expected? What's the status of that? And finally, what guidance do they give the street regarding annual deliveries? Most believe it's going to come in this year at about 1.9 million vehicles delivered. They did 1.81 million last year. Do they give us any kind of specificity regarding guidance for 2024? Remember, the last time that they talked about deliveries, they said that they would be markedly lower. So as you take a look at shares of Tesla versus General Motors, and yes, General Motors over the last year has outperformed Tesla shares, keep in mind that the focus is going to be on that conference call. And that's going to be the determining factor, Tyler, in terms of what we see shares of Tesla do. If there's not a whole lot of specificity, if it's the typical Elon Musk, what we often hear from him, which is robotaxi's great, it's going to change the world, I'm not sure it's going to do much to move the stock higher. We'll have to find out during the conference call.
Well, let's find out from somebody who owns the stock. Phil, thanks very much. Shareholders' perspective now. Our next guest thinks today's results are going to be lackluster, but still sees opportunity ahead if the company can pinpoint its long-term self-driving strategy. Joining us on set is our friend Nancy Tengler, CEO and CIO at Laffer Tengler Investments. Nancy, welcome. Good to have you with us. I have to say that I am skeptical that a robo-taxi is a savior for this company.
I think the market agrees with you, Tyler. Listen, this is a CEO who...
I mean, not that the company needs savioring, you know.
Well, right, but I mean, it has been a bumpy patch, to be sure. This is a CEO who thrives in chaos, and it really bothers everyone around him, including the investors. When I first got into the stock, it doubled. This was like 2018, 16 maybe. It doubled, and then he started smoking pot on the Joe Rogan show, sleeping on the factory floor. People were quitting right and left. And so I got out at I took a double. And it's up 555% since when I sold it. So I think what you have to be willing to do is sort of suspend your logic and look at the ways the company could pivot. And this is a pivot point. I mean, margins are shrinking, self-inflicted, took some share. He still has over 50% share of the EV market. Margins are still the best in the auto industry. But I think you want to look at things like the mega battery business, which is utility-grade batteries that are growing at 50% a year. They're the lowest cost provider.
Don't underestimate that, in other words.
Exactly.
This is not just a car company.
It has a lot trading more going on that.
It's trading as a car company.
Yeah, but it's a tech company.
Back to the robotaxi. I'm not sure. Does a robotaxi have to have a driver in it? Because if it doesn't, and those taxis have some malfunction at some point, even they just can't navigate around some construction that's gone up overnight, they're going to become very unpopular with other motorists
and very quickly.
And town councils very fast.
That's right. So I live in Scottsdale, and right. I commute a third of a mile, and I every morning I
a whole third of a mile.
It is rigorous, and sometimes I'm
what
late.
What a burden you have to face.
But I see a Waymo car every single day coming and going. So they're all over the place. I've seen them run red lights. I've seen them kind of have a little difficulty in parking lots. But I think the data is getting better and better, and most all of them do not have a driver. So to be the second sort of adapter in this particular space, I think will be an advantage for Tesla.
You like the stock?
If it sells off today, and we have very low expectations, and even if it doesn't, we're going to be adding to it. It's not a major holding. We acquired it in January of last year at about 104 a share. We sold it in the low to mid 200s, and we bought some a little too soon at 180. I'll be adding to it in here because I think 3 to 5 years, you're going to be glad you own the stock.
Let me switch gears. I read one of your notes, and you seem a little put out with Jay Powell.
Don't tell him.
I did, I'm afraid.
I am, Tyler. I am so tired of the flip-flopping. And, you know, I've been at this over 40 years. I've never seen a more hapless, dissatisfactory Fed chairman. And now we're in a mode where I think the market is not listening again and we're paying attention to earnings. But we are starting to see a slowdown in some of the industrial names. We're getting, you know, they're beating on earnings, but they're lowering guidance. We're seeing it in the consumer staples names. So I think they're going to cut this year. But I'm still drawing an analogy to the 1990s where, you know, Fed Chairman Greenspan cut three times, let it ride, after aggressively raising rates in 94.
I think of this moment as in a very polite, measured version of Jim Cramer's famous rant where he said, they know nothing, they know nothing. What are they thinking? You remember well, I'm sure.
Yeah, I do. But I think what bothers me the most is their models don't work. Hmm. And yet they keep repeating them. And so there was an article in the Wall Street Journal I referenced in my notes, can't remember the title, where he basically said, why is the Fed always wrong about inflation? Their models don't include fiscal spending. Chairman Greenspan was very well aware that fiscal spending was inflationary. And he didn't opine necessarily, but he went to Congress. And when they grilled him, he said, stop spending money. So
Nancy, great to see you.
You too.
Thanks for that. And I really commiserate with that third of a mile commute every day. Nancy Tengler, appreciate it. And one last Tesla mention, CNBC Pro ran a screen and found six S&P 500 stocks that tend to rise when Tesla shares fall. eBay and Wells Fargo are among them. For the full list, head to CNBC.com/pro. Meantime, coming up, the House passing the measure that could ultimately result in a TikTok ban here in the U.S., but parent company ByteDance showing it's not going down without a fight, a very expensive fight. We'll dig into big tech's lobbying spend next. All right, let's give you a quick market check. The Dow up 302 points right now. That's about 0.75%, sitting very near its session highs. We'll keep an eye on that for you at 38,543. Meantime, with the acceleration of AI and the threat of a TikTok ban, it may come as no surprise that technology lobbying has ramped up this year. Emily Wilkins joins us now from Washington with the numbers. Hi, Emily.
Hey, Tyler. Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. This TikTok bill, these data privacy bills, that really intense hearing that we had on kids' online safety, really no shortage of issues for tech lobbyists so far in 2024. And a lot of the numbers reflect that, particularly for Meta. They set a new record for lobbying within the first 3 months of 2024, spending over $7.6 million, according to lobbying disclosure documents. Now, for comparison, they spent around $4 to $5 million each quarter of last year. A Meta spokesman said the increase was actually less about policy and more about when Meta employees, including their lobbyists, got their bonuses this year. But Meta lobbyists spoke to lawmakers, agencies, and the White House about issues including China and AI. And other tech giants like Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and Apple also spent millions lobbying the government in that first quarter, although their spending does more roughly match their past quarters. And when you look at what all five big tech companies are lobbying on, it's a lot of the data privacy bills that has gained momentum in recent months with a new bipartisan bicameral bill seeking to give consumers more rights to their data and requiring that companies be more transparent with how they handle user data. ByteDance, the parent company of TikTok, also had a major quarter for lobbying. They spent $2.68 million in the first 3 months of 2024. That is double what they spent in the last quarter of 2023. And senators are now about to take that first vote on moving forward with a bill that would ban TikTok in the U.S. unless it divested from parent company ByteDance.
Tyler? Yeah, we're told, Emily, there are two votes here. One is to table that TikTok vote motion. The other one is to move forward with it. It's all part of the procedural stuff that goes on Capitol Hill all the time. What can you tell us about that provision, that TikTok bill? And as I understand it, if the TikTok part of this goes down, the other parts, namely funding for Ukraine, Israel, and the South China area, Taiwan, and so forth, that gets stalled as well?
Well, this is really the fascinating thing about congressional process. It is so complex. You know, the House actually divided this bill up into four separate votes, but the Senate's not. They're saying, okay, everyone at the same time, you got to vote on that $95 billion in foreign aid for Ukraine and Israel, and you have to vote on TikTok, and you have to vote on all these other provisions. So they're really wrapping it up in a big package. And I think the hope is there for certain Republicans who might not be a big fan of voting for Ukraine funding, might be convinced to come along with funding for, say, Israel, the Indo-Pacific, and this potential TikTok ban. But lawmakers in the Senate, they're really not getting the chance to kind of identify what they do or don't like about this package. On the other hand, it will probably make it more likely for this package to go through and wind up passing either today or tomorrow.
All right, Emily, thank you very much for that explanation. I appreciate it. Straighten me out. All right, coming up, rates, regulators, and relaxation. We've got the action, the story, and the trade on Visa, Boeing, and Hilton. Ahead of their results, the exchange is next. Earnings exchange is next, I should say. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. We got more earnings ahead, lots of them. We're going to look at Visa, Boeing, and Hilton in today's earnings exchange. And here to do it is Lee Munson, Portfolio Wealth Advisors President and CIO. Lee, welcome. Good as always to see you. We're going to start off with Visa shares currently on a four-week losing streak. Consumer spending, higher rates, alternative payment platforms are what's in focus here. How would you play Visa right now, Lee?
You know, I wouldn't. It's sort of lagging the S&P. It's a market perform. I think the game here, certainly there's information. Buybacks are great. Dividends are great. We understand the competition. Visa is doing a lot of infrastructure, building out Mexico for payments. They just did an acquisition in Brazil. But when I see that, you know, going international and trying to acquire, I get nervous. The problem with Visa is that everybody's waiting to see if management doubles down on guidance that's going to lead them to high double digits revenue growth for the rest of the year. Outside of that, you've got something with a 25, you know, plus forward PE, and there's not a lot of, let's say, news that's going to spark this stock up. I think, to be fair, it's amazing that a company this size can produce revenue growth the way they can. I would just say, I hate when analysts say this, market perform, I'd rather buy an index fund.
All right, let's move on to Boeing, down more than 30% this year. Troubled company, troubled stock. This report is going to reveal the impact of that Alaska Air door plug blowout. Barclays watching the fallout, including regulation on MAX production and CEO Dave Calhoun's planned departure at the end of the year. Lots and lots of moving parts, literally, here. What would you do with Boeing?
Not to mention, Tyler, that on Monday, one of the high up executives said that we're going to have a problem on the Dreamliner because there's a couple parts they need to complete. So we're not just in 737 MAX territory. We have the Dreamliner that, you know, they can't push out. Here's my issue. Last 2 years, they've been hitting about 500 planes delivered per year. Last year, about 525, year before 480. They don't even think that they're going to be able to do 350 planes this year. I think this is a value trap, number one. Let's say we got over the 737 problem. You have the best environment in the world this decade, not this year, not next year, this decade in aerospace. And it's heartbreaking to see a great American company not being able to execute. I feel this is a value trap. I'd rather buy it next year when I actually see planes getting delivered And hopefully Airbus doesn't eat their lunch between now and then.
All right, let's pause for just a moment and remind you that Boeing CEO Dave Calhoun, soon to depart there, as Lee mentioned, is going to join Squawk on the Street, Squawk on the Street, to discuss the company's results. That's tomorrow in the 9 p.m. Eastern hour. It is a CNBC exclusive. You do not want to miss that. And finally, Lee, let's move on to Hilton. Shares on pace to snap a seven-month streak of gains. Mizuho expecting softer revenue per available room. That's ARPU, I think, is what they call it. But noting Hilton's exposure to higher-income travelers and the Asia-Pacific region as catalysts as the travel trend continues. What do you like or dislike about Hilton, Lee?
You know, all that news is out there about the return of high-end travel. I find this is a fascinating stock. They just did this acquisition of Graduate Hotels. And what it is these little hotels that are around major universities, right? Boring. It's like a Peter Lynch chatbot is chirping in my ear saying, do you have a company that has a really something boring and profitable going on? I don't think this is about the return of business travel or high end. I think this is about over 500 units that they're going to be adding to their 7,500 units that they have right now of these properties that are going to be moneymakers. Also, they're delving into the lower end, which Hilton hasn't done before, with their Spark line that's just started, and their Live Smart, which is sort of like a extended worker, you know, housing and all that. So I think a lot of the great things about Hilton coming down have nothing to do with what Mizuho is talking about. I think it's about this lower end that they've never tapped. Could happen.
Love the Graduate Hotels. Stayed in several of them. I think they're a good brand, good value proposition. Lee Munson, thanks very much. Lee is with Thank you. Wealth Advisors. And that does it for The Exchange. Power Lunch is next. Seema Modi will be there. I'll see her in a moment.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day. Same time, same place.
People today can spend half their lives over 50. So it's good to be financially ready for what's important to you as you get older, like a family vacation.
Cannonball!
Or starting your dream business.
Welcome to Connie's Coffee. How may I help you?
AARP's trusted financial tools can help you plan for whatever your future holds. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Start planning today at aarp.org/moneytools.